Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 142, and it's a continuation of sorts. It's part two of a three-part live series featuring experts in the JFK Records Act. And those experts that are with us today are Andrew Eiler and Mark Adamczyk. We're going to get right back into the live episode. But before we do that, I thought it might be helpful if the listeners actually heard the specific language contained in Section 6 of the Records Act. This is the section of the Act that delineates the specific reasons that a record can be detained and held back from public release. So, here goes. Section 6, entitled Grounds for Postponement of Public Disclosure of Records. Disclosure of assassination records or particular information in assassination records to the public may be postponed subject to the limitations of this act if there is clear and convincing evidence that one of the following exists. Item number one, the threat to the military defense, intelligence operations, or conduct of foreign relations of the United States posed by the public disclosure of the assassination is of such gravity that it outweighs the public interest, and such public disclosures would reveal A, an intelligence agent whose identity currently requires protection, B, the intelligence source or method which is currently utilized or reasonably expected to be utilized by the United States government and which has not been officially disclosed, the disclosure of which would interfere with the conduct of intelligence activities, or C, any other matter currently relating to the military defense, intelligence operations, or conduct of foreign relations of the United States, the disclosure of which would demonstrably impair the national security of the United States. Item number two, the public disclosure of the assassination record would reveal the name or identity of a living person who provided confidential information to the United States and would pose a substantial risk of harm to that person. Item number three, the public disclosure of the assassination record could reasonably be expected to constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy. And that invasion of privacy is so substantial that it outweighs the public interest. Item number four, the public disclosure of the assassination record would compromise the existence of an understanding of confidentiality currently requiring protection between a government agent and a cooperating individual or a foreign government, and public disclosure would be so harmful that it outweighs the public interest. Or, item number five, the last item, the public disclosure of the assassination record would reveal a security or protective procedure currently utilized or reasonably expected to be utilized by the Secret Service or another government agency responsible for protecting government officials, and public disclosure would be so harmful that it outweighs the public interest. Well, that's it. Hope you are enjoying the live episode. So, without further ado, let's listen to episode 142 as we get right back into it with Andrew and Mark. We're back. So we were right in the middle of a raging debate about what, you know, what's within the confine of the legislation that really has teeth in it that, you know, compels the agencies to actually comply. I think you all probably remember exactly where we're at. So I'll let you pivot back in and you go from here.
I started looking at this statute about 5-6 years ago, and there is not a lot of teeth per se in the statute. It's there's provisions for judicial review. There's requirements for periodic review. There's provisions for oversight. The problem, Jeff, is the agencies have treated this law as a light suggestion and not a requirement of the United States Congress. And so while any statute could be drafted better, I see that every day in my practice, it does have a number of things in there. Not to get into the legal world too much, but you can talk about a private right of action, who has the right to enforce the statute. There's definitely enough in sections 4 and 5 of the JFK Act to require agencies to collect their assassination records, turn it over to the archives, where the ARRB, the board would, require clear and compelling evidence as to why a record should be postponed. The problem is, what really happened, based on my understanding, is that the ARRB was an independent body, and they were left in a negotiation with agencies. It wasn't supposed to work that way. The agencies turn over all the records to the archivists, and then the ARRB would make determinations and recommendations for a fine. And if an agency went to the ARRB with a postponement request, it had to be based on clear and convincing evidence under the Section 6 standards that we've talked about in this podcast. And then the ARRB would make a final determination, and their determination was final. And if they agreed that a particular record could be postponed for a period of time based on the Section 6 standards, a living person, sources and methods, law enforcement, military operations, then that would be binding. So the problem was when the ARRB, as Andrew mentioned, stopped its work in September of 1998, there really wasn't an enforcement mechanism to make sure that the work of Congress was done. You were left with the archivist to maybe remind them, say, hey, you know, this is what the ARRB said. This is when it has to be released, and the agency would come back and say, well, no, we need more time. So I think that's a lot of what happened between 98 and 2017. My understanding is that a lot of the records that went up to President Clinton and in the mid to late 80s, when there was a disagreement between agencies and the ARRB, Clinton would just say, you guys work it out, negotiate something. That really wasn't how the statute was supposed to work. If there was a disagreement, the president had the authority, in my opinion, at that time to make a record by record certification if there was a legitimate and compelling reason under sections 5, 6, and 9 of the act to authorize postponement. So it was the way that it's written compared to the way it actually operated in practically is a problem. And we're still seeing that to this day. And I know Andrew has really drilled down on that. And that's why in 2023, we're still seeing this negotiation and song and dance between agencies and the office of the president.
Yeah, I really like the way Mark just laid that out. Between 92 and 98, when the ARB made these decisions on a record by record basis, again, if they didn't disclose the record and they determined that a record met the criteria set out in Section 6, they issued their final determination to postpone that record. And along with that determination, they made a recommended release date. That recommended release date was part of their final determination. So if you look at Section 6.1a, with clear and convincing evidence that there's a threat to military defense intelligence based on an intelligent agent whose identity was currently requiring protection, they could postpone that record. So if that agent died or no longer required protection, in that ARB decision, they would have specified the exact recommended date. They may, as Judge Tunheim has said publicly, they may have said, release it upon the death of the agent or within 10 years of the expected death of an agent, given that the assassination happened in the 60s and 30 years had passed when the ARB was making these determinations. I think they typically felt if someone was 90 or 100 years old, there was not an expectation that that agent or asset would continue to require protection. So again, those recommendations were part of a final determination by the ARB. Well, between 98, when the ARB shut down, and 2017, another, you know, almost 30 years had passed. Those recommendations were obviously not implemented by the National Archivist, who had the responsibility with the agencies to conduct the mandated periodic review. The release of those documents based on the final determinations of the ARB should have been happening on a regular basis after 1998 for the, I mean, at one point, I think it was close to 30,000 withheld records up until 2017. So that never happened. The archivist did not implement the ministerial duties imposed and mandated by the Act. That's a problem. But that problem was compounded after 2017 when the president and the National Archivist essentially just threw out the Section 6 criteria of the Act and determined that the only criteria that they needed to meet was under Section 5G2D. And I'm not sure if you want to get into the Gannon memo at this point, Jeff, but that is the basis for the government, particularly the president and the archivist, making Section 6 and Section 9 no longer operable law.
Yeah, let me just add one thing to what Andrew said, which is important. He referenced John Thunheim. Judge John Thunheim was the chairman of the ARB. He's still a sitting federal judge in Minnesota, and he still to this day is talking and giving interviews on this subject, and he's been livid about how the act has been carried out as compared to how it's supposed to operate. And you can go online and see a lot of his comments on not only how the ARB was stonewalled by agencies in 92. I mean, this is 30 years after the assassination. So in 92, when his board was empowered to get these records released, the complete frustration of Jim DiGenio tells a story, or it's out there, and how Judge Thunheim and his staffers would go meet with the agencies, and they would sit down in a room and they would put a document on a screen. And Thunheim and his staffers would say, well, what possible reason could you have to justify postponement of this record? And they would sit back for a couple of minutes and eventually they'd say, well, you know, give me a minute, I'll think of something. So that's the level of resistance that they encountered. And he's still talking about this and is still passionate about it because he took a sworn oath to make sure that the only problem he countered is they only had 4 years. And then after those 4 years, starting in 98, going into 99, essentially nothing was done. And the agencies, in my opinion, I think Andrew would agree, they just kind of waited out the ARB and they were able to, run the show up until 2017 when Trump had to make a decision and they ran the show then again.
Let me ask a couple of questions. First of all, to get back to Andrew's question, yes, I absolutely want to cover the Gannon memo. So we definitely want to do that. But before we get into that, real quickly, a couple of questions. Jeremy Gunn, who was the general counsel for the ARRB, and who, as I understand it, based on comments he made that I've seen on video post-1998, that he's seen all the documents that at least were available as of 1998. I don't know if the collection has really been added to much since then. I don't think it has, but it, you know, he's made public statements that, hey, I've seen it all. I've seen it unredacted, and there's just no smoking gun in it. Like, what does that mean? I mean, that's one man's opinion, although it's one man who's a pretty important person in the, 60-year history of the review of those documents. Does that carry weight in any of this? I mean, how do you all interpret, I don't know if you've seen that clip, he was speaking at, you know, some conference or something somewhere about it. But I've always wondered, for reviewing that, here's a guy who's had complete insight into it. I didn't always agree with what they were concluding at the ARRB and some of their investigative work. And he didn't always want to go as far as people like Doug Horne did. But at the end of the day, he was a guy who was probing perhaps more than any other prosecutor had ever probed on certain topics up to that moment. So does that have any bearing on this? Is you all have an opinion on it?
Yeah, Jeff, I think one, neither Mark and I have focused almost exclusively over the last few years on the act. I don't think either one of us hold ourselves out to be, you know, assassination experts in terms of the evidence or the details. But I can say this, and your shows have clearly highlighted some of the work that Doug Horne and Jeremy Gunn did back in the mid-90s, particularly with respect to the medical evidence and the autopsy evidence. I can say I have looked at the interviews and depositions that were conducted by Gunn and Horne during the ARB term. And while you couldn't call them smoking guns, what they did is clearly show that the information that was presented by both the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations and the Rockefeller Commission were not telling the picture that eyewitnesses at Bethesda and at Parkland were stating under oath. And your listeners should go back and really listen closely to the recorded depositions that you've put in your earlier episodes. I think Gunn and Horne did a phenomenal job getting that information on the record in under oath statements back in the 90s before many of these witnesses have passed on. So smoking gun, I think as many of the best researchers have indicated, there's not going to be one document that goes so-and-so pulled the trigger. But what it does is it creates a fuller picture on a piece-by-piece basis. Some people have called it a mosaic, that taken individually, there isn't one pivotal document. But I think the ARB especially has done an amazing job at pulling together, with great resistance from the agencies, a ton of information that really has put together quite a clear picture as to what was happening in the various agencies with Oswald and with other key actors that were part of both the lead up to the assassination and the follow up, and particularly the medical evidence.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the way you just summarized it is spectacular. The idea of it being a mosaic, and you know, I mentioned that in the preamble, and I believe that there isn't going to be one document that you're not going to open up a document and say, you know, here's the evidence that these five people were involved in the conspiracy and this is what they did. It won't be, you know, some treatise like that. So I totally agree with that view of it. And by the way, I want to be clear. I believe the ARRB did a phenomenal job as well. You know, obviously, I think they were the more appropriate and probing agency when compared to, you know, sort of the three major reviews that were done over the time span between 64 and 98. So I appreciate that. Mark, do you have any other comments on that as well?
Yeah, I mean, it you know, I completely agree that the ARRB did everything they could within a span of 4 years to identify, collect, and analyze assassination records. They weren't an investigatory body. They weren't charged with, you know, solving the assassination, but they did have a very powerful mandate under the JFK Act to collect the records and make sure everything was disclosed to the American public. So, you know, I've seen the clip you're referencing. That I watched the speech that Jeremy Gunn gave. It was very good. We just have to wonder, you know, did he really get to review everything in unredacted form, or are there records that have still not been turned over into the collection? And there's still records that are subject to litigation, namely the Joannides records. And we can talk about that for a second, and the lifelong journey that journalist Jefferson Morley has embarked on to get access to those records. Because in my opinion, with the several thousand records that are still withheld in full or redacted, that's a collection that I believe the CIA will fight tooth and nail, even if there's a court order entered against them at some point, that they will never release, because it will show most likely intelligence connections to Oswald that they simply cannot explain at this point in time, nor do they want to explain. So that's another hot topic. And it's not a hot topic. It is a topic. It's something that is undeniable that there was intelligence connections to Oswald both before and after. Well, before the assassination from New Orleans onto Dallas, lots of knowledge about him historically that CIA came out and said, "Well, we don't know much about this guy. We have no knowledge." But that's over the years with the declassification compelled by the ARRB and efforts, as Mr. Morley and through the years have shown, that there's a lot more to it than that. And that's, you know, not to get too much into the weeds, but I think that's the most plausible reason for continuing the secrecy, is they one side of their mouth to say this, we don't know this guy. He was a lone nut and we didn't know who he was. And what is coming into picture through the mosaic, so to speak, is that there was a lot more to it than that. And that's probably, aside from, you know, embarrassing records and just records that show nothing, you know, what I've learned through this whole thing is that the CIA, just out of arrogance, or the FBI or whatever, they just want to have secrecy. They want to look at a document and say, that's mine, it's secret, you have no right to that. So that's one problem. The other problem is that there are records, in my opinion, that do show more to the story about what the government knew about Oswald and the connections to him in the months leading up. Now, you know, you can go back to Russia, you know, the false defector program, but that's that you could go back that far. But the real secrecy, I think, lies in when the operation went into place, the connections to Oswald and his publicity, how he went public in New Orleans as a pro-Castro sympathizer, was a designed effort towards some operation, which eventually went to Dallas.
Well, just to follow up too on what Mark is saying, it's kind of funny. I don't know the exact number. What did they say in the last release, that there were 14,000 records released? But then immediately there are talking heads on the mainstream media who are saying there's no smoking gun. So there's 14,000 records that were supposedly released. Once actual researchers start to dig into those records, they're finding that most of those records actually have already been previously released. And what's happened is there's a partial lifting of the veil. in that within some of these 14,000 records, they haven't released the fully withheld records, but the lifting of the veil in a partial manner is that some redacted words or sentences from some of these records have been removed. So the redactions have been removed. So they've exposed a word or a sentence or a couple of lines, and they're saying, well, these records have been now released publicly. They've been disclosed, but there may be further redactions that have not been removed in these records. So it's really difficult to say with any specificity what has been fully released, what hasn't been released. And the fact that National Archives, and particularly the National Archivist, who has the mandated statutory duty to maintain identification aids for each record and to provide an index of these identification aids, that really hasn't happened in a way that will assist in understanding the full scope of what's being withheld, what's being fully and finally released. And that's a real problem because, again, you go back to Section 2 and 3 of the Act. The Act was put in to provide an accountable and enforceable system to downgrade and declassify all the records until all the records are fully and completely released to the public.
That's a good summation of that. I want to go back just real quickly for listeners who may not be familiar. Most are, but some may not be. George Ioannidis played an important part as a CIA liaison between the CIA and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, but it was unbeknownst to the HSCA what his relationship was at the time, and some of his duties that included things that happened in New Orleans, and none of that was disclosed to the particularly I think to Robert Blakey, who was particularly critical of the fact that that disclosure wasn't made during that time frame. I believe I have that correct. Is that true? Which is one of the reasons why it's become so controversial, along with what those records probably do say.
Yeah. So just a bit of history on this. George Ioannidis was a CIA operative connected with JM Wave in Miami. And he also had a residence in New Orleans, even after the assassination, when the Warren Commission was investigating the crime. And it's now very clear, even though there's still some withheld records, that Jeff Morley has been fighting tooth and nail to get, that he was a case officer running or managing the DRE and anti-Castro operation, mainly out of New Orleans, that now it's clear that it connections and contacts with Oswald. And on the afternoon of the assassination, literally, I don't know, 3-4 hours that afternoon, there was already newspaper and media releases about Oswald and his background going to Russia, being, you know, the Fair Play for Cuba committee, all those types of things. The only way that could have been out there that quickly was from a CIA-backed operation, a propaganda operation. So we know that for sure at this point. That was quickly covered up, of course, when it went to the White House and to the FBI and to Hoover, and hence we had the Warren Commission. Fast forward 15 years, the HSCA was investigating the, thankfully, they still had a chance, a very good chance at that point, especially with Sprague and Tannenbaum, you know, running, you know, the legal side of it, had a very good chance of getting down to what happened. So HSCA investigators were meeting with the CIA to get the records and to go through all the evidence, what happened. And guess who comes up as the CIA liaison to work with the HSCA on records and quote unquote cooperation? It was Mr. Ioannidis. And they never it was never divulged to the HSCA. And as you said, Jeff, eventually Bob Blakey took over that committee, that he was the CIA operative that was in charge of that anti-Castro Cuban operation in 1963 that had contacts with Oswald. If that had been known, whether it was to Sprague or Tannenbaum or Blakey, it would have just blown the whole thing up. So it's now pretty clear at this point that was another CIA operation. Andrew and I have talked a lot about this, about an ongoing operation to suppress evidence, and that's definitely one of the highlights of it. And those records are still maintained as classified and secret to this day. And that's the story on that.
I think Robert Blakey has even gone on the record and said not only would have George Joannides not been accepted as a liaison from the CIA, but he would have been called as a witness.
Right.
Which is a pretty damning statement to the level of deceit that was being played by the CIA.
Well, and it's to be honest with you, it goes back to maybe the point I was trying to make a little bit earlier with you all, that, you know, then we go and pass a piece of legislation that we presume that they're all going to continue to be good actors when we know they weren't. At the end of the day, I know the timing of that was such that not all of that came out prior to the legislation itself. But, you know, I guess the intent of this legislation, and you all tell me if I'm wrong on this, is very clear. Regardless of whether there are things that could have been crafted better, and Mark, as you say, you know, the crafting of legislation is a political process, and you hardly ever get a perfect piece of legislation, but it's a pretty darn good one, and it's pretty clear in terms of its intent. Regardless of whether there's a focus on voluntary disclosure, the question really remains whether or not they've really completely complied with this. And I think when you get up at 100,000 feet, it's not just the CIA, right? I mean, I know the CIA gets a lot of focus because, you know, of some of the obvious reasons over the years, you know, where there's questions as to whether or not there were elements of the CIA that were involved in the assassination, the secrecy that they maintain generally, so on and so forth. But isn't the, you know, Office of Naval Intelligence a good example of where they've never provided a record and they would have been subject to the same provisions of this piece of legislation? And I may be wrong about that, but, and correct me if I am wrong, but, you know, there are areas of gross noncompliance that are really beyond, to some extent, you know, even what the CIA is, you know, done.
Yeah, I mean, the way the act reads, every government office is subject to the act, so it doesn't exempt any agency or office from turning over all of their records that could possibly be related to the assassination to the archivist for review by the ARB. Then, you know, you could talk about the Secret Service, and now what's come out is destruction of records. And it gets that bad. So no, every government office was subject to this act. It's a very powerful statute in favor of the American people. It's just the way that, you know, as Andrew and I have studied, the way that it was supposed to work and the way that it has worked to this day is completely at odds. And that's the problem. And that's why we're talking about it today.
For sure. Well, it's probably time to pivot to the Gannon memo, because, you know, a lot of people, and again, without being partisan in nature, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, we've now had a Republican president who resided over the act when it came to matriculation in 2017. I've got Biden, and they're all doing essentially the same thing that everyone else has done, which is to defer to the agencies under which they have control, you know, and support the idea that a lot of records should still be withheld. You know, as a president who gets into office, you really have to ask yourself the question, as a bystander who's not subject to really understanding what's underneath the covers, then when you get there, you get a glimpse of what is underneath the covers. And I'm sure there's been a lot of interest in it. You know, Bill Clinton was a president that was closer to that period of time, obviously had the opportunity prior to his completion of office to, you know, essentially be quite impactful to those disclosures. And yet all of them seem to have seen things or at least come to some conclusions that would allow them to support the agencies involved. And this whole thing about the Gannon memo, which you're going to get into, seems to me that it's a big game of rope-a-dope until they eventually exhaust the American people and the American people just lose interest. It's worrisome. And something like this Gannon memo, which I believe was originated under, you know, the Trump administration and has continued to be relied upon even in the Biden administration, is somewhat bipartisan then in nature. I want you guys, I'm going to stop talking in a minute, because the history behind this memo and who wrote it and what else he wrote is quite interesting too. So I'll stop there and let you guys take the conversation from here. But it's a really amazing sort of set of facts around this. So I'm really anxious to hear it.
I think, Jeff, that the fact is both President Trump and President Biden likely had the desire and the intention to fully release all of the records. Coming into office and leading up to October 2017, President Trump made it very clear publicly that it was his intention to release all of the assassination records without exception on October 26, 2017. And I have to think that President Biden had that same intention. But what appears to have happened leading up particularly to the October 2017 deadline that's in Section 5 of the Act is that the agencies at the very last minute exerted a fair amount of pressure, call it whatever you want, I'll call it pressure, on President Trump to do a 180 on what he had publicly said and to withhold a very large amount of the assassination records. And
let me just stop you right there. I mean, that is the proximate question, Andrew. Why? What's in them, right? I mean, you know, we're still back to the fundamental question. You know, we know it happened, but why?
It just jumping in real quick. It could be as simple, Jeff, as I think it was Pompeo, the director at the time, and whoever else. They go to the president. They say, if you release these, you're going to be, you know, compromising the national security of the United States. So if you're Trump and you have, you know, 200 documents on your desk and you have to deal with, you know, umpteen different things in a day, and they say you're going to be compromised, do you want to be the president that compromises the national security of the United States? I mean, do you think that Trump or Biden sat down with their legal staff and looked at 15,000 records and went through them and made determinations? No, that's the pressure that they have on the office of the president. I think it might be as simple as that.
Yeah, they waited to the last second, and sought their postponements, and it really didn't give President Trump particularly the time to review these records on a record by record basis. It's unlikely, and due to the work of lawyers in the research community, there have been FOIA lawsuits and FOIA requests to get to the bottom of what happened with regard to the National Archives and the work in 2014 leading up to 2017. It's interesting. I mean, it would be interesting to have all of that information put out so the public can see the dialogue between National Archives, the National Archivists, the agencies. The public should know this. And these records will hopefully soon become available to everyone on Mary Farrell Foundation's website and in the news. Let's find out what was happening. But it was clear that there was a reversal on President Trump's interest in releasing all of these documents publicly. Now, what we have found out in 2017, and this is typical for any executive order or decision the president seeks legal counsel from the Office of Legal Counsel in terms of the legality and lawfulness of any decision, any kind of legal consequences. And the JFK records decision was no different. And so what happened is President Trump sought legal counsel from the Office of Legal Counsel. An individual named Curtis Gannon, who then worked for the Office of Legal Counsel, was put on this matter to provide the president with the basis for releasing or postponing the records. And this Curtis Gannon's legal opinion was turned into a memo to President Trump, and it's available to the public.
Join us in the final episode, 143, of this three-part series, where Mark Adamczyk and Andrew Eiler discuss the Gannon memo, which attempts to blow a hole in the government's requirement to release the remaining JFK records. Thank you for listening to bonus episode 142, which is the second of three live episodes related to the JFK Records Act.